Danley, this is New Hampshire Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Diabetes is a chronic metabolic disease affecting how your body uses glucose or blood sugar, and glucose is hugely important as a source of energy for your cells, so if it's off balance, you're going to have problems, including frequent infections, high blood pressure, loss of feeling in the feet, and in the worst cases, even blindness and death. And diabetes is on the rise in America, especially its most common form, type 2, related to poor diets and lack of exercise. But lately, there have been a few nuggets of good news in this field. In April, federal researchers said rates of serious health complications related to diabetes, strokes, kidney failure, heart attacks, had dropped dramatically by 60% over the past two decades. And here in New Hampshire, Dartmouth doctors have seen some success in treating certain conditions that can lead to diabetes. Today in The Exchange, a new discussion on diabetes. If you have personal experience with this as a patient or a health provider, tell us what you're seeing. And if you have general questions or comments about this rising trend of diabetes and what it all means, join us as well. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests for the hour. With me in studio is Della Flanagan, certified diabetes educator and registered dietitian at Concord Hospital, where she manages the diabetes program. And Della Flanagan, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here. Also with us, Dr. David Nathan, Director of Clinical Research Center and of the Diabetes Center at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. And Dr. David Nathan, great to have you too. Thanks for your time.
You bet.
And also with us, Dr. Richard Comey, professor of medicine at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine. His specialties include diabetes, cystic fibrosis-related diabetes, and endocrinology. And Dr. Comey, thanks for your time as well. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, and Dr. Nathan, I want to start with you. You have called diabetes the chronic epidemic of the millennium. That's pretty dramatic. What are you trying to say there?
Well, I think the numbers speak for themselves. In the past about 25 to 30 years, diabetes has reached these epidemic proportions, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. It seems to be linked really intimately to the change in lifestyle that we've had probably earlier in the U.S. than in other parts of the world. And that involves people gaining weight, following a more sedentary lifestyle. When we go to work, it's usually not work that involves perspiration. We're usually sitting behind a desk looking at a computer screen, and this kind of cultural revolution that has gone on, and which is now, by the way, catching up in China and India and in many other parts of the world, seems to be linked to a genetic risk that we all have for developing diabetes. And the combination of the change in our environment, the work we do, the weight we've gained, and this genetic risk seems to have led to this explosion of diabetes.
Oh, so that's interesting. So you're saying that there is now a link between lifestyle. I mean, I understand the link between lifestyle and diabetes. That's been talked about a lot. But you're saying that's affecting our genes, Dr. Nathan?
Well, no. So we all have genes. Those haven't changed very much. In fact, they haven't changed at all, probably in hundreds of thousands of years. So the gene pool that we have is the same, but within that gene pool, each of us has different minor genetic variations. It's what makes us look individual, different than the other person. And some of those genes protect us from diabetes, and there's a whole raft of them that can increase our risk, each gene just by a little bit. And so that's the common genetic setting that we have. However, it usually doesn't cause you to have diabetes unless superimposed on that genetic background, you gain weight, you become less active, and then diabetes really takes off.
I see what you're saying. And I'd love your thoughts too, Dr. Comey. From what I understand, for example, the CDC had some new numbers just out this week, and diabetes isn't looking good.
Yes, diabetes is becoming more and more common in the U.S. population. And I think to support what David was saying, I think the notion is that we all have genetic tendencies that are somewhat different, and some of us store calories better than others, and some of us, in the presence of a lot of food, will actually have higher blood sugars than others. And it looks like that's a fairly prevalent situation in the country. At least 25% of the population can have abnormal blood sugars if they're presented with the right sort of environmental milieu. So we're seeing this. We're seeing more and more unmasking, if you will, of that genetic tendency. But it does appear to be environmentally influenced, both positively and negatively. That is, you cannot do something about it by adopting a lifestyle that mitigates the problem.
You know, and we keep talking about lifestyle, and yet I came across a fact sheet. It's myths versus facts from the American Diabetes Association that said most overweight people never develop type 2 diabetes, and many people with type 2 diabetes are at a normal weight or only moderately overweight. So what about that, Dr. Comey? Help me sort this out.
Well, again, you know, it's certainly true that most obese individuals do not have diabetes. And again, I mentioned it's about 25%, maybe as much as 30% of the population that can have this sort of tendency. On the other hand, type 2 diabetes, which is generally what people mean by diabetes, it's about 95% of diabetes in the country. There's a lot of different ways to get to type 2 diabetes. And so one way is to have this genetic tendency that's brought out by weight and inactivity. Another way is to have other defects in your ability to regulate your metabolism. And many of those people would actually be of normal weight. So we can see a lot of different ways to become diabetic. Unfortunately, the complications are similar no matter how you become diabetic.
Our phone number for you to join our conversation here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the Exchange, we're getting an update on diabetes, some new numbers, some new concerns as the numbers only continue to grow. 1-800-892-6477. A little bit later on, we'll look at some of the breakthroughs in terms of treatment and management of this disease. Join us now with your questions and comments, though, at 1-800-892-6477. Again, email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Della Flanagan, you've been working in this field for some time. You're a diabetes educator. What are you seeing there?
I see more and more people being referred to our program. I know that throughout the state, there are more certified diabetes educators working with greater numbers of patients. And certainly it's a great, great field because we can really help people understand this disease and take care of it a lot better than without seeing a CDE.
Who is a typical patient for you, Della?
We have type 1s, type 2s. A typical patient will be an overweight type 2 patient who is newly diagnosed and is petrified about what this means because they have a family history. They've seen really horrible things happen with their grandparents. And so I think the first thing that a CDE needs to do is find out what people are afraid of and what they want to learn and coach them along the way.
And CDE is?
A certified diabetes educator.
Sure. So you're helping people through the process. You know, we keep talking about type 1 and type 2. And Dr. Comey, just very quickly, for people who might not understand the difference, can you untangle that for us?
Sure. So type 1 diabetes is what used to be called juvenile onset diabetes. And commonly, although not always, individuals are diagnosed in adolescence. These individuals don't make any insulin at all. They don't make insulin because their immune system has destroyed the cells that make insulin. So they require insulin for survival and can only be treated with insulin therapy, and it has to be 24-hour insulin therapy. In contrast, patients with type 2 diabetes generally show up in middle age, and usually these individuals still are making a fair amount of insulin but are not responding to it, and the amount of insulin they make gradually declines over time, so ultimately a fair number of them wind up on insulin therapy. That division between juvenile onset and adult onset is not clean anymore because of, unfortunately, the obesity problem in childhood has led to type 2 diabetes now showing up in adolescence as well as in middle-aged adults.
So we can't even, Dr. Comey, call it adult onset anymore because kids are getting it.
No, you really can't do that now.
50 years ago, Dr. Nathan, what do the diabetes numbers look like? I mean, you don't need to give me down to the last decimal point, but I'm just wondering how much this has changed.
Well, it's changed usually. I mean, if you think about 50 years ago, the prevalence, that is the occurrence or frequency of diabetes in the population, was more like between 2% and 3%.
Really? That low?
50 years ago, and now it has gone up by something like four. In 50 years, gone up by about fourfold. It's doubled in the last 20 years or so. So, I mean, it really is skyrocketing. I should say it's a slow skyrocket. I mean, it's gone up rather slowly here. In other parts of the world, especially where we do really good epidemiologic research, where you actually follow populations, you can see in places like China, which over a 10-year period or so, as there's been more industrialization, as populations have gone from farming and physical factory work to doing more of our kind of what we think of as modern-day work, sitting at a desk, their rates have just—they have skyrocketed, really over a very brief period of time, going up from, again, 2% to 8, 9, 10, 11% over the course of really 10 or 15 years. So we're seeing there an even accelerated catch-up, if you will, with what we've had over a somewhat longer period of time.
Let's take some calls, all of you. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. First up is Christine in Woodstock. Hi, Christine. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. It seems to me my kid's overweight and probably may be prone to diabetes. It seems to me such a hopeless battle to try and change the direction we're heading in, because it's so hard to get fresh food that's nutritious and fresh food, and it's so hard to make yourself go exercise. And how are we ever going to stop the trend in China or here? You know, how are we going to stop the trend? How are we going to make people work harder to be healthier?
Christine, it's a great point. All three of you want to hear from you. But Della, this is right up your alley, this feeling of, you know, her kid's overweight, and it's just, it's a losing battle, she says.
It's a great question, Christine. I think that first and foremost, the most important thing as a mom is to be a great role model. And one of the suggestions that we make to people all the time is try to have a fruit or a vegetable at every meal and snack. And I think if we do that, we end up eating less high-calorie, empty-calorie foods. But there are many things that can be done as a family, like hiking, that do not cost a lot of money, and teach wellness and the importance of physical activity.
Wow. Well, it is tough, though, and I could go into, we're heading into a break, but after the break, we should talk a little bit more about that, because it's easier said than done, as Christine says. So, Christine, thank you for the call. We'll talk more in just a moment, and we'll take more of your calls, questions, comments about the rising epidemic of diabetes in America. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Back in a moment.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Good morning. I'm David Darman. The Exchange is coming to the North Country. Join Laura Kanoy and a panel of experts as they discuss the state of the Main Street economies north of the Notches. You can attend this special event at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem on July 10th. Reserve your tickets at nhpr.org. Made possible with support from the Neil and Louise Tillotson Fund. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Dartmouth-Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health. 13 locations statewide. Information at d-hdocs.org. And Liberty Utilities, helping homeowners convert oil or propane heating systems to natural gas before fall. Details on conversion programs at libertyutilities.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the costs, treatment, and epidemic of diabetes in America. Give us a call with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. With us is Dr. David Nathan. He's at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Della Flanagan's in studio, certified diabetes educator at Concord Hospital. And Dr. Richard Comey, he joins us from Dartmouth, where he's a professor of medicine at the Geisel School of Medicine. His specialties include diabetes and endocrinology. One more time, that exchange phone number for you to join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, just before the break, we heard from Christine, who said, you know, yes, she hears us, but as she put it, it's a losing battle. Della, I want to go back to you, but also hear from our other guests. A little more, if you could, please, on you know, yes, everybody knows fresh fruits and vegetables and get out hiking, but easier said than done.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one suggestion that I would have for everyone is it is difficult to problem solve over the radio and find out, you know, all the different things that the family likes to do and likes to eat. And I think sometimes a visit with a registered dietitian to assist that progress would be helpful. There are so many areas of that we can address. We can look at what's the typical breakfast that you love to have, or what are your favorite foods, and incorporate that into a lifestyle that hopefully works and improves everybody's health. And sometimes it's not all about weight loss. It's about weight maintenance for children. So we don't look to have children lose weight a lot of times. We look to have children grow into their weight.
All right. And I want to hear from you, too. I think, Dr. Comey, you next. I'm sure you've heard from other parents who say, yeah, my kid's overweight, but it's tough.
Yes, we hear this all the time, Laura. It is very difficult. And it's because it's a whole societal issue about our attitudes towards food, our attitudes towards food portions, our attitudes towards relaxation and exercise, and our attitudes towards work. So it's a very, very complex business. And diabetes really does invade the person's entire lifestyle. So usually you need a lot of support to help with this. Seeing diabetes educators participating in support groups turns out to be very, very important. On the other hand, you know, I mentioned that about 25% of people have a tendency for this to get higher blood sugars. But we know from a study that was done in the diabetes prevention program that the rate of which people can go from a little trouble with glucose to diabetic level glucose can really be cut in half by adopting straightforward lifestyle measures like about a 7% or to 10% weight loss, regular exercise, and being careful about their dietary habits. So we know that really efforts that are within the reach of everyone can be very helpful here, but it is difficult to maintain them.
Well, and I do wonder, Dr. Nathan, you know, it's hard to fix the whole puzzle all at once, but Della referenced this, you know, look at what you're doing, small changes that you can make. I have read that sugary drinks, Dr. Nathan, are in particular a problem because, you know, unlike a cookie or an ice cream cone, where at least there's some food involved, a sugary drink is just basically injecting sugar into your system. Now, have I got that right, or is that an exaggeration?
Well, no, it's one example of where we can easily, way too easily, get in really empty calories. I mean, where just the sugar goes in, you don't need it. So I think that is one example. I'm glad that Rich brought up the diabetes prevention program, because with all of the doom and gloom that we're kind of talking about, that diabetes is approaching almost 10% in the population, and people over the age of 65, it's probably about 25%. So, you know, very common. But on the other hand, this study, the diabetes prevention program, demonstrated, as Rich said, that, you know, rather modest changes in lifestyle can lead to a substantial decrease in the development of diabetes. So in that study, there was a 58% reduction, more than half.
Wow.
Reduction in the development of diabetes in people who were at very high risk. I mean, in that study, which I've been part of since it started in like 1996, you know, it was just a 7% loss of body weight, which was about 10 to 15 pounds for most of these folks. And when they lost that amount of weight, these folks who otherwise almost certainly would have gotten diabetes were able to prevent it. So people can make changes. And although I'm incredibly sympathetic to everyone who says how tough it is, and it is difficult, and once you've gained weight, it's hard to take it off, and as you get older, it's hard to take it off and keep it off, I think we do need to start early on. And a lot of it involves just being more active on a daily basis. It's the little things. I mean, in fact, the program that came out of the diabetes prevention program was called Small Steps, Big Rewards, because the idea was that, you know, you didn't have to take up competitive, I don't know, fencing, jumping, running, skating. But, you know, all you needed to do was walk more. And if you did that and cut back on the fat in your foods, for example, those are the tools that were used in the diabetes prevention program.
All right. Let's take some more calls if we could. Christine, good luck to you. I hope this provides some help for you. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And let's go next to Wilton, where Serapin is on the air. Have I got your name right?
Oh, yes, you do. Serafin.
Okay, go ahead, Serafin. Thanks for calling
in. Well, I had a couple of questions. One was early onset juvenile diabetes. There have been some talk of its relation to other infectious diseases like chickenpox, and perhaps we have an onslaught of the immune system working very hard to get rid of one disease and then developing diabetes. So any of your, it hasn't been talked about much lately, but I wondered if any of your guests had a comment, and then I had another question.
Why don't you give us the other one, Serafin, and then we'll deal
okay.
with it.
Okay. Well, the other one had to do with the pumps that are used in diabetes in children and adults that are used to deliver appropriate insulin. I feel that we're really lagging behind. The Europeans and the English have pumps which detect the sugar. They actually administer the insulin, and they keep a running total of where you are all the time.
Make it a
little
easier.
I think in our country, because we spend billions on diabetes and we give all those billions to pharmaceutical companies, that those billions ought to be involved in this question.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in, Serafin. And Dr. Nathan, I think I'm going to throw the first one to you. Links between other stressors on our immune system and diabetes.
Right. So I'll be glad to tackle both of them briefly. So the first question is whether, in fact, there are either viral triggers or other infections that may actually bring on type 1 diabetes, what we used to call the juvenile form. And the answer is that although there have been a couple of viruses that may actually cause pancreatic damage, the sense is that the folks who have this tendency to autoimmunity, and type 1 diabetes is one of those diseases. The more common ones, frankly, are thyroid disease, either overactive or underactive thyroid, caused by autoimmunity. But for the people who develop type 1 diabetes, most of the common thinking these days is that they have a predisposition because their immune system is in somehow, you know, can't tell the difference between an infection and their own, in this case, their own pancreas cells that make the insulin, and that the viral infections are just kind of are there, and they may stimulate the process. But even if they hadn't had that viral infection, they would have gotten it at a later time anyway. So this idea of a viral trigger being there has been talked about for years, but there's not a lot of good information to suggest that that's what's going on. With regard to insulin pumps, it turns out that all of those fancy insulin pumps are actually made by U.S. companies. And it is true that the European companies, or the European countries, rather, had those pumps that shut off automatically, for example, if the blood sugar was low. They were approved in Europe first, but now they've been approved in the U.S. It turns out that we are, in fact, way ahead of anywhere else in the world in developing a true artificial pancreas. So that would be an insulin pump that acts just like a pancreas. It turns on, it goes up, it goes down, depending on what your blood sugar is. And I think that we've got about another, well, I'm going to guess 3 years or so before those are actually available and being marketed, hopefully. And the U.S. has played the leading role in developing those, I can tell you that.
Interesting. And Dr. Comey, your thoughts also on this question of, you know, how we're doing, how the Europeans are doing, the ease with which diabetics are able to, manage their insulin levels?
Well, I think care is very similar both here and in Europe. We tend to be a little bit more technologically focused, actually, if anything, on things like pumps. I think the Europeans, of course, have more nationalized programs and more nationalized programs for specific diseases, where we have more individualized care. I think care in the U.S. probably varies from place to place more than care varies across a country like, let's say, England or France, where they have more of a nationalized system. But I think we're very similar. As David said, you know, these new pumps that are coming in for type 1 patients will be very exciting. And although they were approved first in Europe, they certainly are in use here. And we expect to see them more sophisticated as time goes on. If anything, though, I think we tend to be more technologically focused here, but the care varies from place to place.
Well, and I do wonder, Della, another critique of our system is that because we have these big medical companies, there's an overemphasis on here's a drug you can take, here's a cool product you can use, instead of doing the grunt work, which is what you do, which is, you know, a little less sugar, a little less fat, a little more exercise.
There certainly are a lot of different medications available to patients, and we always encourage lifestyle changes first, and if A1C doesn't improve, then work with a provider to figure out which next medication is appropriate. And there are some designer drugs out there that cost more than the old-fashioned sulfonylureas and metformin, sometimes...
Wait, what was that you just said before?
The sulfonylureas, those are old-fashioned drugs that we've used forever. And metformin is now the first medication of choice for people with type 2. and very inexpensive, so that's a great thing. And then after that, the provider can choose from a variety of like 5 different classes of drugs, some different injectables that are not insulin or insulin. So there's many, many choices for people. And the role of the diabetes educator a lot of time is to let people know what choices there are out there and what they would be interested in taking.
So, Della, how often does it happen where someone comes into you, they've been diagnosed with diabetes, they're terrified, as you said before, and you tell them, well, you know, you really should be eating more fruits and vegetables and stop eating fried chicken, and by the way, you could walk to work, and they say, you know, I'd rather just take a drug. It's easier.
Right. And the role of the diabetes educator is also to use motivational interviewing. So as much as we would like to say you should be doing this, you should be doing that, you should be, we really try to engage the patient to help solve their own problems and determine what lifestyle changes they can make on their own, because people do know what they need to do. And I think if they're encouraged and listened to, they're more apt to make the decision, a positive decision to make a lifestyle change, than for me to say, I don't think you should be eating that. I don't think you should be drinking that colada that has 800 calories every day. I think it's a much better relationship and a much better outcome if we use motivational interviewing with people.
I remember a colleague of mine who was a good 15, 20 years older. He'd been diagnosed with high cholesterol. So, you know, similarly, you're supposed to watch your lifestyle. And he said to me, he said, you know, I'm just going to take the pill because I don't feel like bothering. Whatever statin it was to lower his cholesterol.
It's unfortunate because, you know, it would be great if people looked at side effects of all of these medications.
All right. The phone number again here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Barbara's calling in from Walpole. Hi, Barbara. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, thank you. My question is type 2 diabetes reversible? Or once you've been diagnosed with it, do you have it forever?
This is a really...
If you change your lifestyle, are you then non-diabetic?
It's a great question. Thank you so much, Barbara. Dr. Comey, what do you think?
So I think we get into sometimes semantics. If you regard diabetes as a condition where the blood sugar is high enough to cause damage to various parts of the body, various tissues, including the nerves, the eyes, the kidneys, and blood vessels, you can lower your blood sugar enough that damage will not be occurring through a lifestyle change. Whether you want to call that a cure of type 2 diabetes or you want to call that a delay, because you also get older and age does play a part in developing type 2 diabetes, is a question of semantics. But the issue to us is, can you get your blood sugars down low enough that they're no longer damaging these tissues? And the truth is, you can do that with lifestyle so that you can get to non-diabetic level blood sugars, particularly early on in the disease, and perhaps delay meeting the diagnostic criteria for 10 or so years. We do see this with patients who have gastric bypasses where they have diabetes level blood sugars and then they undergo this procedure, lose an enormous amount of weight, plus have a sustained very low calorie diet, and we see their blood sugar numbers drop into the normal range or near normal range. If you tested them with a lot of different techniques, you might still be able to show they have abnormal responses to blood sugar, therefore they have diabetic physiology, but it's not at a level that's harming their other tissues anymore.
Interesting. So can they say that they're cured or not really?
Well, like I said, it's a question of semantics. I guess you could say they're not diabetic at this point.
Yeah,
I'm
interesting.
I'm not sure I'd use the word cure.
Right. Dr. Nathan, I love your thoughts on this, too. Is it curable, reversible? Pick your word.
Well, so I agree. No, I completely agree with Dr. Comey, but I must say that it's rare enough. I mean, you heard him stumble as to what we call it. We don't have a name for it, because it's pretty rare. For the most part, people don't lose weight in a permanent way. Their diabetes remains in place. That said, though, people can reverse the metabolic abnormality. That is, they can lower their blood sugar levels and get off medicines completely, and I guess you would have called them, what, former diabetes? It is unfortunate, however, that sometimes when people have developed damage to their, let's say, their vessels in their eyes or vessels in their kidney, that even though the diabetes is better, those complications may still persist. So they've actually done damage to an organ, and then it doesn't go away necessarily, even though they've cured themselves of the high blood sugar. So, you know, it's complicated,
and
it doesn't happen very often, but it is possible.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So to some extent, the damage is done.
Well, it may have been done. On the other hand, if you intervene early enough and you actually go to your doctor on a regular basis, your physician or healthcare provider then test your blood sugar, they find out at the earliest possible time when it starts to rise, and you implement changes in your lifestyle or you go on a simple medication at that point, you can actually completely delay or prevent the development of any disease associated with the diabetes. And that's something that people need to understand, is that we actually do understand now how to prevent disease from developing.
Well, that's really a great question, Barbara, and one I had as well. So thank you for joining us. As we sort of sort through the semantics of this, here's another term that I want to ask you about. And Della, I'll go to you first. 86 million Americans could be considered pre-diabetic. Again, these are these new numbers from the Centers for Disease Control that we're looking at. That's a lot of people. What does pre-diabetic mean?
Pre-diabetes means that you do not have a diagnosis of diabetes based on the numbers that are out there. A hemoglobin A1C of 6.5 and above is considered a diagnosis of diabetes. And hemoglobin A1C, this is an average blood sugar test of 3 months, of 5.7 to 6.4 puts you in the pre-diabetes range.
So you're getting close to the
diagnosis,
the tipping point,
but not quite yet. And a lot of these people are obese, and if they lose weight and exercise, they can prevent ever getting diabetes. So I think this diagnosis is one that is great to have because you can actually do something about it and reverse and never get the diabetes, which is something you can't do for other diagnoses.
How many of these folks do you think, Della, know that they are pre-diabetic?
Well, that's a really good question. We just did a population health program at the hospital and ran reports to find out how many people, of one doctor's panel had pre-diabetes. And some people knew and some people didn't know. So I'm not sure exactly. I think they do have numbers, but I don't know it off the top of my head.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't need specific, to the decimal point, but I am guessing that a lot of folks who are pre-diabetic have no idea.
That's true. And not everybody has an A1C done at their routine panel.
Dr. Comey, what do you think? How do you ferret these folks out? From what I understand, a lot of them don't even know they're pre-diabetic.
Well, it's certainly true that probably most of them don't know that they're pre-diabetic. There isn't, at the moment, a formal indication to screen every person in the population. What's done is to screen people who have risk factors for diabetes, such as a family history of diabetes, people who are overweight. There are some organizations that recommend screening everyone at the age of 40, which is sort of the age at which people develop type 2 diabetes. But I agree with Della that I think it's a very useful thing to know because you really can do something about it at that point.
All right. We will take a lot more of your calls after a short break. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More conversation about diabetes in just a moment.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Good morning. I'm David Darman.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the fight over sleep regulations in the trucking industry and the dangers of drowsy driving. Then a look back at the dress doctors, the women who made America stylish in the early 20th century. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show beginning this morning at 10 on NHPR. And support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from North Branch Construction, celebrating 56 years in business. From custom-built homes to eco-friendly commercial buildings, on time, on budget, on Facebook, LinkedIn, and northbranch.net. And R.M. Davis Incorporated, celebrating 36 years of providing investment counsel, wealth management, and trust services with offices in Portland and Portsmouth, online at rmdavis.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the diabetes epidemic in America, given some new numbers from the Centers for Disease Control that show diabetes diagnoses continue to rise, along with a large number of Americans who are pre-diabetic, perhaps 86 million Americans. The number for you to join us with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Dr. Nathan, I'd love your thoughts, too, on those 86 million pre-diabetics, people who don't even know that they might be predisposed to this. How do you ferret those folks out?
Well, you know, so I think one of the things to first grapple with is that, remember that about a third, maybe 30% or so, of people with diabetes don't even know they have it.
Wow.
And so that's where we think that the damage really starts accelerating. So I think what Rich and Della said earlier is that we don't know, you know, how many people actually know or don't know that they have prediabetes, because screening for this is not done universally. You can detect diabetes or the problem of prediabetes using the same tests. I mean, it's a fasting blood sugar will help, a hemoglobin A1C, which has been mentioned. That's a blood test that shows what your average blood sugar has been over the preceding 3 months. So it's nice. It's an average index of blood sugar levels. And either one of those, depending on what level you're at, will say that you either have prediabetes or that you've actually gotten a level that is high enough to be considered a diabetic. But the problem is, without the routine screening, we don't know who has these things. The term prediabetes is, and I unfortunately helped introduce that term a long time ago, it's not a great term, because people think that it may mean, oh my, I'm going to get diabetes for sure.
Right.
But in fact, of that group, probably about half of them will never get diabetes, and a half of them will. So, you know, it just means that you're at higher risk, and that might be a better term, you know, higher risk for diabetes or something like that.
Well, Dr. Comey, so how much is it sort of standard operating procedure for doctors to test people, even people who look, you know, perfectly healthy?
I don't think it's a standard operating procedure right now to look specifically for diabetes. Lots of physicians get what are called basic metabolic panels, and those tend to include all of them actually include a glucose. If it's a fasting glucose, there are criteria which can indicate that the fasting glucose is higher than is usual and put you in a pre-diabetes class. And that's the most common way I see people identified as pre-diabetic, is that in just a general blood test that was ordered, not specifically looking for this, it turns out that their blood sugar in the fasting state was greater than 100. And if it's greater than 100 on two occasions, we would say they have prediabetes. There's a lot of discussion back and forth about the cost effectiveness of screening for diabetes. Depends on what side of this you're on. I'm certainly somebody who believes that giving people information when they can actually act on it is really very valuable. And I personally would like to see more screening for diabetes done, but it's not a routinely recommended procedure right now.
Now, that surprises me, Dr. Comey, given the numbers that we're seeing. Again, the new numbers released just this week that show this really rising to concerning levels.
Yes, you would really think so. Again, it's one of these cost-effective analyses. It's very expensive to screen everyone in the population, and the outcomes are far in the distance. But in terms of of a call to action, I think someone seeing their blood sugar is 106, 108 at a time when they could really make some lifestyle changes and change this. As David mentioned, they could cut their risk in half of developing diabetes over the next 6 or 7 years. So again, I'd like to see a change in that.
So what do you think, Della? Someone comes into your office, they're trim, they're healthy. Are they going to say, I don't need a diabetes test, or I couldn't possibly have diabetes, I'm not overweight?
20% of people who actually have diabetes are not overweight.
And type 2?
Type 2
not
diabetes.
Not the genetic, you're
so
born with.
So not everybody
type 1.
We see is overweight. The majority are, but certainly there are some that are not. We have people that originally were overweight and they lose weight and their control is so much better that they can actually almost diet for an exercise to manage their diabetes, which is always a wonderful thing to see.
Okay, let's take another call. This is Reeve in Wolfboro. Hi, Reeve. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for waiting.
My pleasure. Great conversation. I am frustrated that you've gone this far in the conversation and not talked about the fact that the sugar subsidy industry is enormous. So I have one solution for this, but I'll just comment that we're upset about this, but it's a little bit like having the tobacco industry be subsidized to put hidden tobacco in our breakfast cereals and in the schools and in meats and in every single food we eat, and then complaining and working on how to fix the diseases that ensue. So
go to the source, you're saying, Reeve.
Yeah. One thing I'd like to point out is that the movie Fed Up is playing in Concord right now at the Red River Theater, which is exactly about this. And my solution for me personally has been, I don't eat things with a label. We need to be able to read labels and clearly identify all the hidden names of sugars and see that they're in every single package, but I don't eat things with a label. I eat a tomato or a chicken or whatever.
Well, thanks for calling in, Reeve, and I have heard about the movie Fed Up, about the hidden sugars in our lives and the role that it plays in these health problems that we have, including, of course, diabetes. Dr. Nathan, what do you think? The sugar subsidies are fueling this. It's a political question, but, you know, go ahead.
No. It's a perfectly appropriate political question. And as you know, there's, of course, a swirling political debate about whether Michael Bloomberg and now Mayor de Blasio in New York, do they have the right to restrict the size of, you know, soda cups and et cetera. I think that this is a deeply rooted social problem that we have. And as Reeve points out, you know, there's some food industries that are subsidized. On the other hand, in cities, often you can't find fresh produce that's affordable. And that is, you know, that's not because it costs necessarily more to grow, you know, fresh produce that's healthy for you than it does to import sugarcane or whatever. There have been decisions made over time. So agribusiness is hip deep in this. And all of our hips are getting wider because of that to some extent. That said, I think this needs to be a really population-based response. We need to feed our kids more healthily. We need to make sure that they're active. We all need to make an effort to do this. And it'll be helped enormously if we can get the sugar out of canned foods. You know, recently Michelle Obama had a major victory, I thought, when she got Walmart to, you know, agree that they weren't going to buy canned foods that had a lot of salt in it. And the manufacturers, you know, they shrugged a little bit, they fought a little bit, but they said, oh, well, you know, Walmart's not going to buy the cans unless we get some salt out of it. And it turns out that they did that with a flip of a switch, essentially. So I think that some of those, you know, kind of industrial approaches to this are necessary. So I agree with Reeve that we need to readdress these issues and do it continuously.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you for the call, Reeve. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You know, all of you, we've talked mostly about type 2 diabetes because it is related to lifestyles, because, as you all have said, it's rising so much. But just returning, Dr. Comey, for a moment to type 1 diabetes. Again, this used to be called, I think it's still called, juvenile diabetes. It's what you're born with, you know, not your fault. Is there a cure for type 1 diabetes, Dr. Comey, or is this something that you just have to live with?
Well, you know, this has been a subject of great research over the years. You would think it would be fairly straightforward because we have a fairly straightforward cause, which is the person doesn't make insulin because their immune system has destroyed the cells. Can we do something to prevent their immune system from destroying them? There are some medications that can really reduce the activity of the immune system such that it stops destroying the insulin-secreting cells. But unfortunately, we need our immune systems for lots of things, and so that's not really a safe approach. There's a lot of interest in stem cell research, creating new islets, which then you could infuse into the patient that would replace them. And I think that's a technology that's still developing, slower than many of us thought, but will be very, very likely to cause, to provide some improvements in the future. The big problem with that is you have to make those islets in such a way that the body won't destroy them too, or else you have to use obnoxious medicines that cause other health problems. So in terms of a cure, we'd love to actually have a way of interfering with the exact medical process or pathophysiologic process. We don't really have safe medications for that, although there have been attempts. And we have the notion of replacing them, which I think stem cell research offers a great promise for that, but it's going to be down the road a bit. In the meantime, we have pancreas transplants, which work very well, but again involve using medications that have other side effects that are pretty unpleasant, and we really can't really transplant everyone in the country who has type 1 diabetes.
Yeah, and I read about some of the work that you're doing at Dartmouth in terms of transferring pancreases. It just sounds amazing, Dr. Comey, just really cutting edge there.
Yeah, it's an interesting program. It's not really about diabetes per se, but there are people whose pancreases have given them tremendous pain because of recurrent inflammation. And one way to treat that would be to remove the pancreas and replace its functions. One of its functions is to make insulin. And the novel thing that's done here is to actually isolate their own cells that make insulin and then give them back to the patient, and they set themselves up in the patient's liver and work really well. That's a really nice program. It's working really quite well. It's analogous to islet cell transplant, in which you isolate islet cells from donor pancreases from people who have passed away, and then infuse them into patients. Islet cell transplants also work, but they seem to have a relatively short duration before they have to be redone. And so that's been an area of active research as well. But the program at Dartmouth to give people back their insulin-secreting cells and take out the pancreas that's inflamed has been very interesting to watch. And actually, those cells are isolated down at Davis Institution at the Mass General, so it's a cooperative effort.
And Dr. Nathan, I want to ask you about research as well in just a moment, but here's an email that came in that I was interested in. Carol in Vermont asks, what is the likelihood of a woman who gets gestational diabetes developing diabetes later in life? Dr. Nathan, can you address that? You do hear a lot about gestational diabetes. It happens all of a sudden in perfectly healthy women during pregnancy.
Right. So gestational diabetes affects on the order of some, you know, the numbers are debated, but somewhere between 3 and about 8% of all pregnancies. And the sense is that during pregnancy, there are hormones that are lots of hormones. It's a high hormone state. And some of those hormones actually will antagonize the effects of insulin so that, again, 3 to 7% or so of women will get this diabetes that occurs towards the latter end of their pregnancy, usually, and which then, after the delivery, goes away.
So most of the time it goes away.
So it goes away after delivery. It goes away, if not uniformly, but certainly the vast majority of the time. However, within 5 or 10 years after that pregnancy, many of these women, about 50%, about one half of these women, will get type 2 diabetes. So it's almost as if the pregnancy showed their tendency to get type 2 diabetes, and then they get it later. It turns out that this diabetes prevention program looked at those women, and again, lifestyle intervention worked well. Decreased the risk of them developing diabetes by more than 50%. There was a medication we used called metformin, which is a very commonly used drug to treat diabetes, and that also was effective in preventing or delaying the development of diabetes in women who had had GDM, gestational diabetes.
Let's take one more call if we could, and Richard is joining us from Amherst. Hi, Richard. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hello. I've had diabetes since I was 10 years old, more than 50 years.
Wow.
One of the things that I picked up very early on was that I probably wouldn't live for very long. And in recent years, I've become a storyteller, and I've got a story where I talk about my 5 years. Diabetes is a sort of a disability. Certainly, it's something that requires your attention 24 hours a day.
Yeah, constantly watching it. So as a kid, Richard, I'm kind of interested in this. You got the impression that you weren't going to live that long?
That's true. I was in a hospital when I was first diagnosed with a lot of people who were suffering from various complications. The father of one of my sister's friends had diabetes and died, and his daughter eventually died as well.
Wow. So, and Richard, I'm sorry to cut you off there, but I do want to jump in on this with our guests because it's real interesting. To me, Della, it shows how far we've come. People don't regard diabetes as a death sentence.
No, not at all. And that's a huge role for the certified diabetes educator to let people know that, you know, it will be a little bit more challenging to do all of these things, but everybody can live a very long, healthy life with diabetes. I mean, we know when insulin was discovered back in 1920, it wasn't the great insulin that we have today, but people were living for like 90 years using that old-fashioned insulin. So, yeah, it's sad.
But today it's even better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. What do you think, Dr. Comey? We used to look at this as, oh, my goodness, you're not going to make it. And now here we are. And here's Richard, our caller, doing fine.
Well, he's certainly right that in the 1960s, people were told that this would shorten their lifespan significantly. I would mention that shortly after that, glucose monitoring came in and really revolutionized the ability of the patient to take care of themselves. And this is a self-care disease. But on top of that, it's a comprehensive disease. So if you take a comprehensive approach and monitor their blood pressure, monitor their cardiac function, and treat risk factors for other things, we really can have a fully normal lifespan. And we really have seen a tremendous success in reducing the mortality, the early mortality of diabetes, both in type 1 and type 2, by paying attention not only to their blood sugars but to everything else. And they do need comprehensive care. But it's... it's a nice success story that he's able to call us to tell us that he's had diabetes for more than 50 years. And I'm sure it's been a huge effort on his part to take care of himself, but it's he's been rewarded for it.
Richard, thank you so much for that call. And Dr. Nathan, Dr. Comey talked earlier about some of the interesting research that's going on at Dartmouth in terms of this. Just very briefly, what's one area of promising research that is drawing your attention these days?
Well, I mean, so I'll talk locally. The programs that we have, as Richard noted, that, you know, we are doing a lot of islet research and doing both what's called autologous, that is people who get their own beta cells, their own islet cells that make insulin, given back to them in the setting of having their pancreases being taken out. Looking also at the use of islet cells in type 1 diabetes to, you know, treat people with type 1 who have that autoimmunity. And but looking first at how to decrease the autoimmunity, because as Richard noted, you know, if you give them back new islet cells, they'll just be chewed up again as their original islet cells were. Probably the most exciting thing in terms of what we think will be, again, revolutionizing type 1 diabetes is looking not at what we call biological solutions, like transplantation, but how to make an artificial pancreas. And we already have these pumps, we have monitors, why can't we hook the two together and make an artificial pancreas? And so we've made, I think, really good progress in this, and I expect further progress coming along. On the type 2 side, it's really trying to figure out, again, how to most effectively prevent this from developing, and once it develops, how to treat it most effectively.
All right.
And that's what we're looking at.
Dr. Nathan, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. That's Dr. David Nathan, director of the Clinical Research Center and of the Diabetes Center at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Comey, thank you also for your time.
It's been a pleasure, Laura.
Dr. Richard Comey, professor of medicine at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine. And Della Flanagan, it was good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Della Flanagan, certified diabetes educator and registered dietitian at Concord Hospital. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer today is David Darman. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, reassessing the property tax. New Hampshire, first in the nation when it comes to reliance on this tax, has long debated it. Critics say it's unevenly distributed. Defenders say it's great for local control and better than an income tax. And this familiar conversation is playing out across the country, with other states debating the fairness issue and some offering alternatives. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is NHPR. It's 9:58. The Diane Rehm Show is coming up next. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Granite State Music Festival, June 21st and 22nd at Kiwanis Park in Concord. Proud to support music and music education in New Hampshire. Festival information at gsmfest.org. And the Turner Group of Concord, architects, engineers, and building scientists designing energy-efficient, sustainable buildings for a healthy environment. Online at hlturner.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Researchers say drowsiness is a factor in about 20% of all auto accidents. The New Jersey highway crash that killed one person and injured comedian Tracy Morgan has revived debate over trucker fatigue. Court papers allege